This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Professor Eric Freifogel about owning nature, an ethical question. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Eric is the author of a recent book, The Land We Share, Private Property and the Common Good. We're not going to be talking specifically about that book today. We're going to be talking about the issues that it raises, particularly in terms of ethics and property and land use and things like that. Eric is a professor of law at the University of Illinois. Tell us the name of you're in a named chair. Tell us a little bit about that. What's the name of your chair?
It is the Max L. Rowe Professorship at the University.
And who was Max L. Rowe?
Who is he? Oh, he's very much alive.
Okay.
He was an extremely successful lawyer in Chicago, a longtime friend of the law school, and now lives in Springfield.
And he donated the money for the chair.
He's been a very good supporter to the law school, to the university generally. People like him help us a huge amount. Increasingly, we rely on them.
Now, how long have you taught at the School of Law?
Oh, goodness. Let's see. This is my 21st year.
21. Where were you before Illinois?
I spent a few years practicing law with a big law firm in downtown Indianapolis. Before that, I was with the Department of the Army, working in the Pentagon for 4 years, in the Secretary of the Army's office, doing legal work. That was in fulfillment of an Army obligation that I had incurred, and because the Army was kind enough to pay for my college and first year of law school.
And where did you go to college?
I went to college in Pennsylvania at Lehigh University. I went to law school at the University of Michigan, but I'm actually a native of Central Illinois.
Where'd you grow up?
I was born and grew up in Decatur.
Oh, close by. And so what did you do that made the law school want to give you this prestigious position?
Well, the prestigious position came after I'd been there quite a while. I wasn't brought into it, of course.
You sort of work your way up the ranks.
Okay. That's right. You start off as an assistant professor, an associate and full professor, and in time they hand these things out to the people. It certainly is a very prestigious honor.
You earned that because of your teaching, because of your writing, a combination?
Mostly scholarship. This particular honor, there's various ways that we honor people. There's teaching awards and so on. But this awards like this tend to be mostly for scholarship, although certainly other aspects of your work are by no means irrelevant, the public service, the teaching.
And your main focus in your scholarship has been property, land use, ethical use, legal use, laws concerning property, for how long? How long have you specialized in that?
Oh, well, really from the beginning, although some of my work in the property area was more transactional related. It dealt with real estate mortgages, with installment contracts. I mean, sort of a transactional aspect. But really from the beginning as well, I had quite an interest in resources, the parts of nature that had some economic value and the kind of legal rules that surround it, water law, for instance. I mean, I taught natural resources from the beginning. I've also always or nearly always taught the basic property law course. But I would say over time, my scholarly interests and writings they get broader and broader over time. When you start working on one piece, you realize it really is part of something larger, and then you work on the larger thing and you realize that's part of something larger still. And I would say for quite some years, my writing really has extended well beyond the law because these issues about the way we own the land are tied a lot into how we use the land and how we interact with one another. Our environmental problems are very much linked to the culture, our economic system. So I think to understand them and to talk sensibly about how we might address them, you really need to broaden your consideration quite widely.
Who do you read? Who's influenced you when you think about these kind of issues?
Oh, goodness. I would say I end up having to read very widely. I mean, my office is crammed with books. My home is crammed with books. I would say in terms of sort of academic fields, I have been most aided in my thinking by two of them, by the subject known as environmental history which is sort of a new field, although the issues that it addresses have been around necessarily a long time. The ways our culture has interacted with nature, with the land over the generations. And then environmental philosophy, environmental ethics. There have certainly been others, but those probably are the main two. I would say in terms of individual authors, there are a small number whom I keep going back to over and over and digging deeply into. I think the leading conservation writer that our country has produced lived in the first half of the 20th century, a man by the name of Aldo Leopold. Many people will know him for his posthumously published book, A Sand County Almanac and Sketches Here and There. That was only one of his writings. It's probably the best known, but he wrote literally hundreds of short pieces. Left behind lots of unpublished manuscripts, and I've had the good fortune to have the time and opportunity to dig into them very deeply. A very, very perceptive thinker.
Where did he live?
He lived, a good Midwesterner. You know, I like to say to people, most of the great conservation writers and thinkings have all come out of the Midwest. He grew up actually right on the Mississippi River in Burlington, Iowa. Lived in the Southwest from, about the 1909. I think he was sent out there with the Forest Service until the mid-20s and moved to Madison, Wisconsin, and he was there until the end of his life.
When did he die?
He died in 1948, unfortunately, fighting a fire on a neighbor's land. He really was the leading, I would say, he was the first prominent advocate for wilderness preservation in the country. He was an early prominent professional forester. He probably made his biggest name, though, in wildlife management. He was the first professor of wildlife management, wrote the basic textbook in the field. But really, he is remembered today not for his more specialized science writings or resource management writings, but for his broader writings about nature and culture, about how people live on the land. You know, the ultimate essay in that book is a piece called The Land Ethic, which has been endlessly repeated. In fact, the whole term land ethic, when people talk about land ethics, they will almost always have top of their list Aldo Leopold and the essay that he wrote by that name. But along with Leopold, who died, as I say, in 1948, I would say I've been hugely influenced as well by a contemporary writer, a man who's still very much writing, Wendell Berry, who lives in north central Kentucky. He's a part-time farmer himself. He farms a small farm there. But of course, when you've amassed, as he has, something like 40 books, you really have to call him a writer first and foremost. He does spend a lot of time on it. But he's a poet. He's written a lot of fiction, but he's perhaps these days is best known for some of his short nonfiction writings. He's got his most recent book is one called Citizenship Papers, which has been sort of hopping off the shelves here. It's commentaries on our current national security situation and what it means to be a good citizen in times such as these. But he has written a lot over the years about the ways we dwell on the land and the way we interact with it, and necessarily the way we interact with one another.
Let's talk a little bit about the land in general, and let me invite listeners to join in this questioning of our guest today. We're talking with Professor Eric Freifogel from the School of Law at the University of Illinois about land use ethics, owning nature. And he's the author of a recent book, The Land We Share, Private Property and the Common Good. Who published that, Eric?
It was published by Island Press.
And when did it come out?
It came out, August of this past year.
And where can people find it?
Oh, goodness. Well, it's, of course, in this day and age, you can always find books on the Internet.
Sure.
And at various Internet stores. I mean, I know that the major chains have carried it, but it's not something they're going to put out in the front of the store, so they may or may not have copies of it available at the time. But it's distributed pretty widely.
Okay. Listeners who want to ask a question of our guest or make a comment or tell us of other interesting books and ideas, please call us anywhere the program can be heard. You may punch in 1-800-222-9455, including listeners on the Internet. This program can be heard at 3dub.will.uiuc.edu. And if you're traveling and want to listen to this program, that's the way to do it. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, you can access our local lines by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL locally, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk about land use. Now, it happens I have an interest in this that's just developed fairly recently in my life, because I was elected to the county board a year ago, and I got put on the land use committee. And I can say that publicly because I'm not up for re-election. But so I've been thinking about this a great deal because every month we have a meeting and have to decide, can a subdivision start on this part of the prairie? And can a farmer develop a couple lots in on his property or not, or her property? And I and a number of other citizens elected to the county board decide yes or no. And, you know, we listen to what the zoning people say, and we have to make decisions about this. And to make it even more personal, my wife and I bought some land in the country near here. It had been a soybean field, corn field, and now it's a place we're having a house built. So I have all these personal ethical struggles. You know, should I be taking prime farmland out of production, even though it's just a couple acres, for my personal use? Tell me, am I a good person or not?
Well, goodness. But probably, I'm sure you're a good person.
It gets us some interesting issues.
It sure does. It sure does. You know, when I sort of say to people, I think land use does have ethical dimensions, mm-hmm. it often takes people by surprise because, of course, they automatically see the economic issues to it. But what are the ethical issues? And mm-hmm. I guess I would divide them into two categories. There are, first of all, the social ethics issues, you know, being a good neighbor, being kind to other people in your community, interpersonal issues. And these often come up because people sometimes engage in intensive land uses that interfere with what other people are doing.
Right. Right.
It could be, you know, the smoke. It could be the noise from your property. It could be some other aspect of your land use that's very disturbing to neighbors. They may be neighbors that are a ways away, though. I mean, you could be draining your land in a way that's contributing to flooding downstream. You know, some landowner downstream is being flooded. Or it could be, frankly, that you're in a suburban area. You've got chemicals on your lawn. They're running off. They're joining the runoff from hundreds or thousands of other landowners. They go all the way down the Mississippi. They go out into the Gulf of Mexico, and they're killing all sorts of fish. Mm.
And farmers are putting fertilizer on fields that follows the same path.
You bet. You bet. So, I mean, you could be putting shrimp farmers in the Gulf out of business. So there's this interpersonal side. In addition to that, though, there is, I think, the more ecological side to it. That is, the ways you are altering the landscape in natural terms. And here's where this issue links into this broad area of environmental philosophy. And I don't mean to say that this issue is distinct from humans, but you know, there's lots of things that you can do on the land that might be in modest but cumulatively critical ways upsetting natural ecological processes, wildlife species, biodiversity, you know, maybe hydrologic systems, maybe altering the natural processes that would keep soil fertile. And although it wouldn't seem like much, and maybe in isolation it isn't much, but when lots of people are doing it, it really can alter the land's natural functioning in a ways that can be harmful. Harmful to other life, harmful also to future humans. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of writing on the subject of environmental philosophy where the prime concern isn't directly the welfare of other life forms or species or living communities. It's the welfare of future humans who are coming along. You know, shouldn't they have an opportunity, the people who are going to be living on this land a generation or five generations from now, shouldn't they have an opportunity to enjoy the land, to have the same natural options that we had? So if we foreclose those options by things we do today, that could be troubling.
When you talk about conservation philosophy, where do you start? How far back do you go? What are the guiding principles that you use to evaluate the different laws that different communities come up with?
Oh, sure.
Like
sure.
I heard on the Super Bowl that Houston, apparently the city of Houston, has no land use laws at all. You can build anything you want anywhere.
That's a little misleading. You know, Houston does have a lot of land use laws. They do not have zoning of the type which is common in other areas. They don't divide the land into zones and say, if you want to build, you have to be in this zone. They actually have a lot of public health and safety laws.
Okay.
But still, there is a much greater degree of freedom in land use in land use there. Well, with respect to conservation, I mean, the urge to conserve, of course, has always been with us, with all cultures. You know, historians, as they go back and are reviewing the history of conservation, you know, it seems like every half dozen years somebody comes in with yet a new first chapter in the story. You know, it used to be that the story commonly started in the era of Teddy Roosevelt with, you know, effort to conserve the forests. And then other people said, well, no, but look, we had these wildlife and game laws. You know, elite urban sportsmen in the East in New York in 1870 were out there pushing for laws to protect wildlife and wildlife habitat. More recently, there's been a wonderful book out by a Yale historian talking about efforts in the antebellum period, 1820 to 1850 mostly, to encourage the adoption of farming methods that maintain the natural fertility of the soil, because our nation really had there was so much land in our nation that we really adopted a lot of very bad practices, including practices in using the soil and then just running off. You know, when you exhausted it, just go find a farm somewhere else and start over again. So there was actually in antebellum America a huge amount of soil degradation and soil erosion. I actually don't think that you can understand the Civil War and the role of, say, South Carolina in initiating it without appreciating what terrible shape South Carolina was in ecologically in 1860.
Now, would that be because of cotton, tobacco?
It was originally because of cotton. A lot of it was tobacco. The eastern part, it was rice. But it really was almost any crop in the Piedmont. The Piedmont was horribly eroded by 1860. South Carolina was losing population. It was every 10 years, it was losing representatives in Congress. And it was really feeling like it was being swept aside. And I think that feeling of losing out to the rest of the country was pretty influential in its taking such an extreme role in leading the Civil War. But I mean, I'm sort of interpreting your question here in historical purposes. Sure. There's lots of ways to go into conservation, though.
Is conservation inherently conservative?
Well, I think it is. it's sort of odd that our political spectrum today treats conservation as somehow being a liberal cause,
a liberal
notion, but of course, conservation and conservative are exactly the same word. It's you know, that conservation it is a broad term, and of course, you got to ask, well, what are you trying to conserve? Conservation, we're trying to conserve the land in an ecological sense, not just because it's valuable, but because humans need it and because future generations are going to need it. But the conservation movement, broadly defined, of course, includes other things. It's old houses, it's old neighborhoods, it's historic sites, it's battlefields, it's conserving a quiet, peaceful way of life. It could be conserving, you know, prime farmland, the point that you brought up a minute ago. I mean, the American Farmland Trust is very much a conservation organization out to preserve farmland.
So how do the people who are involved in making decisions about property, about land, we're talking about particularly today, what should guide them as they make decisions about the expansion of cities into farmland where we are here in the Midwest, for example? We've seen it over the last 200 or 150 years in this part of the Midwest. Has that helped more people because more people are able to live here and enjoy the prairie, or has it hurt future generations because we've taken land out of production?
I think most people in the field would answer your question this way, that by and large, it would be good for us to try more than we have to keep our settlements compact, to avoid sprawling out over the countryside. In part because we would like to keep prime farmland available for future use. In part because more compact settlements also cut down the costs of government. We have fewer streets to take care of, fewer water lines, fewer electric lines. I mean, the infrastructure costs are going to be a lot less as well. It also is the case that when we alter lands, inevitably there's going to be a lot of ecological ripple effects to it. We're going to be altering the drainage. There's going to be runoff that goes into waterways. I mean, they're going to be, even though when we look at our yard, we might say, oh, gee, look how fertile and productive it is. Everything in my yard is fine. But there could be a lot of invisible ripple effects that spread pretty widely. Of course, if you look, you know, in big sprawling areas, and Champaign-Urbana is sprawling, if we're not like, you know, Chicago or some other big cities, the more people spread out, the further they end up living from where they work, the more time they spend in cars. And the effects of that can be very dramatic. I mean, I was reading it, one study recently said that for every 10 minutes a person spends commuting to and from work, there is a 10% decline in the amount of public service that person does. It alters life. I mean, I think there's a lot of degradation. The amount of time people spend in cars and travel, I mean, our social fabric, our family life unravels the more that happens. And you know, when you're spread far out, you often don't know your neighbors very much. You know, it's harder to sort of rely upon one another. I mean, there's ill effects to it, but I mean, there's aesthetic aspects to it as well.
Before we get to those, let me at least try a counter argument just for the fun of it.
Sure.
I'm thinking of the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago. You want density of people? Pack them in high rises. Mm-hmm. Put them on top of each other. Put them right up beside each other. But did that create neighborliness? Did that create peace? Did that create a good place to live? Most people would say no. They were finally torn down after, 30, 40 years.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Surely that's not what you have in mind for a good quality of life.
No. You can have good ideas that are poorly executed. And, of course, when I say more compact living, I don't necessarily mean anything like that. I mean, you can have, you know, duplexes. You can have small condominiums. You can have homes that are on relatively small lots and be relatively compact.
Is there
without having to go to high rises like that?
Okay, how much space do people need psychologically? Duplexes. I lived in apartments when I was young and poor, but as soon as I could afford it, I got farther away from
right,
those people who'd be playing their music louder or creating smells that I didn't want to smell.
Sure. Well, that may say more about you than I don't know about human nature generally. I must say I am with you. I mean, I am the same kind of person, but. Goodness, you certainly run into people who just say big city living is where it is, and I couldn't imagine living in outside the city.
Uh-huh.
We want to be in our walk-up. We want to be in our apartment right down, you know, close to the Loop in Chicago or something. I mean, people love it, and it's for many people, it's a wonderful style of life.
Mm-hmm. In terms of preserving land, why is land valued so little in the Midwest if it's so quote valuable?
Well, that gets to the economics of agriculture, and that's a yet more complicated issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are both blessed and cursed here in the Midwest by very high farmland productivity.
Mm-hmm.
We're blessed in the sense that we have plenty to eat, and we can have a bad year, and there's no chance of suffering, really. We're cursed, though, in the sense that the prices are low. It's very hard for farmers to make any sort of living. You know, increasingly,
without subsidies.
Frankly,
right.
They're having to rely upon government payments.
Right.
But it makes it very hard economically to do a lot of things on the land, which frankly would be much better for it ecologically, to take sensitive lands out of production, to leave riparian corridors intact, to provide room for wildlife habitat. It would be great, frankly, in ecological terms, if we could go back to some of the rotations that would have been common 50 or 80 years ago, where there was land in hay fields and in pastures, we had livestock on the land. That decreases the productivity as we would measure it today. But goodness, it would have a lot of ecological ripple effects. I mean, frankly, the statistics I could offer would be almost endless. If you look at populations of things like our grassland birds, even something like the meadowlark,
mm-hmm.
Over the last 50 years, populations down 80%, 85%, 90%, a huge number of them. I mean, birds that used to thrive on pastures or on hay fields, they're not there because the pastures and hay fields aren't there. The amount of land that is subject to subsurface drainage is quite substantial. And even when it isn't, the tilled fields, the water runs off a lot more rapidly. And what's the cumulative effect of that? Well, the water gets into the river much more quickly after after rains. You have a big pulses in the rivers. You've got widespread bank erosion. You've got increased flooding, you know, the kind of flooding that we had in the Mississippi 10 years ago and that we have periodic. It is not natural. It is greatly exacerbated by human land use practices. It's not, though, just the flooding. The corresponding to that is in August, when the stream would be low, as a result of all these practices, it's much lower. I mean, that it gets lower, and that, of course, adversely affects fish populations, and the ecological ripple effects are dramatic.
In this region, as I understand our natural resource history, this part of Illinois around Champaign-Urbana was primarily a swamp. In order to make it habitable or to produce crops, engineers were brought in from Holland and Germany, and drainage ditches were put in, and the land was artificially messed with, technologically attacked, and it changed the use from what had been basically a swamp with prairie grass growing in it. Was then able to produce crops, but also more trees, provide place where people could live. Would it have been better if it had been left a swampy prairie?
No, well, not all of it, no.
How much of a romantic are you?
No, well, sure, that's a good question. I think most of the land around here, you use the term swamp, of course, as a category. Most of it technically would have been called a wet meadow.
Wetland.
And the problem wasn't that it was wet all the time. The problem was that it stayed wet too long in the spring to get crops in. I mean, if you had to get your corn planted by May 15th and your land stayed wet until June 1st or June 15th, you know, you might as well not have it. So there was actually long periods of time when the land around here would have been dry. So it didn't take massive alteration to the natural drainage to dry it enough so that people could get in early enough in the spring to get their crops planted. Surely some of the drainage was helpful. I mean, I happen to think that we have gone way too far in that drainage because there's a lot of ill effects that come from it.
From the subsurface draining, you called it?
From the
tiles in the field.
Surface drainage. Uh-huh. A lot of it, though, is surface runoff, though. A lot of it is altering, I mean, altering the vegetative cover on the land. Having said that, we could still actually have the vast majority, nearly all of our farmlands, adequately drained if we would stop and rethink then what happens to the water when it gets off the farm. Our typical attitude, of course, is let's get it downstream as fast as possible and let the next guy worry about it. And, of course, the more we send to the next guy, the more he's got to send to the person down.
And the reason we're doing that is because soybeans will rot if they have water, if they're standing in water for a week or something, right?
Well, no, the point I wanted to make was you need to get it off the fields, particularly early in the spring, so you can get it in plant.
I see.
I don't think in most of the county that it was wet during the growing season was the problem. Is you got to get it dry enough in so I mean, although I'm sure in places it was that problem. But the point I want to make, and this is actually a very contemporary point locally, and I think it will rise up more around the state. Sure, we need to drain individual farms. We need to get the water into the drainage ditch. But what do we do with it at that point? Mm-hmm. Is it necessary that we then just send it downstream as fast as possible? Or should we instead ask ourselves, are there ways where we can slow that water down, maybe building artificial wetlands here and there, detention areas, that would keep the water from rushing downstream and doing the kind of harm it does? At the same time, maybe providing valuable wildlife habitat, good hunting habitat, good places for hiking and birding, recreational opportunities. It would, in a county such as Champaign, it would not take very many acres set aside along our ditches as detention areas to make dramatic improvements in the ecological health of our rivers, not just along the ditches, but all the way downstream.
So on the current debate that's happening in this county in terms of the drainage that's going into some of the rivers, and some of the drainage commissioners are saying, well, we need to just dredge out those rivers and cut down the growing trees and bushes and things alongside, you would say, no, let's expand that.
I don't feel competent to talk about any individual case, and I don't want to do so. I will say generally, though,
that a wise professor.
Well, no, I mean, that's the lawyer.
You
can't pass judgment on an individual case before you look into all the facts, so I don't know about that. But I would say generally we have been way too quick to drain. And I think, in fact, a lot of it, frankly, is aesthetic, that people think drainage districts, ditches ought to be clean, the water ought to move very quickly. And I guess I would say before we spend taxpayer money doing this, before we start cutting down trees and destroying wildlife habitat, let's be very sure we have a problem on our hands.
Okay.
Because the mere fact that it looks overgrown, the mere fact that the water may be somewhat sluggish, that doesn't mean that we've got a problem on our hands. And even if we do have a problem on our hands, I guess I would say maybe we should stop and say, is there something we can do that doesn't involve such massive alteration, which is obviously going to be harmful and obviously going to be expensive.
Sure.
I mean, I know the case you're talking about locally, this is what, $600,000 or $700,000, which is a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. Before we go spend that, let's ask, is there something else we could do with the money? For instance, could we, you know, could we build some detention area that keeps the water in place?
Some alternative solutions. We'll be talking in just a moment again with our guest today on Keeping the Faith. We're talking with Professor Eric Freifogel, author of the book The Land We Share, Private Property and the Common Good. This is your which book? How many books have you published?
several.
Roughly?
This is sort of sole-authored monographs like this. This is the third, but I've had a few edited volumes
as well.
Casebook and this and that.
My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. You are listening to Keeping the Faith on AM 580 WILL. This program is supported in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. For the last 131 years, it's been helping develop student leaders by providing opportunities for social action and community service. The Y has many programs that deal with the environment. Students for Environmental Concerns began at the Y. The Red Bison program that does prairie restoration is a Y student program. The Rainforest Action Group is concerned with preserving rainforests throughout the world and have done political action and education. Environmental Resources is a publication put out by one of the Y student groups that informs students and others in the community about various opportunities for preserving natural resources in this area. Coming up at the Y this week, we have one of our programs is on Tuesday noon called Know Your University, where people from different parts of the university share what they're doing so others can find out about it. Last week we had Bill Adams talking about the university budget problems. This week on Tuesday, Coach Janet Rayfield and some of the soccer players from the women's soccer team will be our guests at noon. It's a free program. People can come and ask questions, listen to the program. Last year was the 7th year of women's soccer at the University of Illinois, and they had a wonderful season. They'll be talking about that this Tuesday at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street, the corner of Wright and Chalmers. If you want to come and get lunch at the Y Thai Cafe, you're welcome to do that, or you can bring your lunch or simply come and listen to the program. On Friday at the Y this week, Tom Ginsberg from the College of Law will be our guest. He'll be talking about constitutionalism and democracy in Afghanistan. That's February 13, this Friday at noon at the Friday Forum series. Tom Ginsberg is a colleague of yours,
he is,
Eric,
indeed.
An expert on constitutions and particularly Afghanistan. So looking forward to that program Friday.
I'm sure it will be good.
The Y is supported by gifts from supporters, communities, people in the community, alums of the university who were active when they were students. One way we support ourselves in this organization is by accepting donated cars, automobiles, trucks, vans, SUVs, even motorcycles. So if you have a used vehicle you'd like to donate to a charity and take the tax write-off, please consider the University Y. That way you don't have the hassle of selling the car yourself or trading it in and dealing with the used car salesman. You can donate it to the Y, take the appropriate tax deduction. If you're interested, please call me at the Y, 337-1500 during the week. We've had 5 vehicles donated in the last 6 months and have given them good homes, students and others who found them useful, and what they paid the Y certainly helped us accomplish some of our goals of continuing our programs for today's college student. Well, let's get back to our guest. Let me repeat the phone numbers for people who might like to call in. We're available in Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455, and we have several lines that number reaches. Elsewhere, you may call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Professor Freifogel was talking with us about preserving natural resources, the ethical concerns about that. You used a phrase that some people may not know, riparian corridors. What are those?
It just comes from the Latin meaning of river. It's a riverbank. Our rivers, of course, are extremely important in this state.
Yes.
We have a huge number of miles of streams and rivers. In fact, I heard from one person who was in a position, I think, to know that Illinois claims to have more miles of streams and rivers than any state in the country, which may sound odd, except that if you stop and think about it, the kind of land that would have lots of rivers would be a humid land that is relatively flat. Because you end up then with lots of streams that meander around. And these rivers in Illinois are particularly important because they provide some of our most important wildlife habitat, our most important recreational opportunities, the hunting, the birding, and the like.
So many of them have practically become sewers and then had to be rescued. I think of the Chicago River, for example. And
That would certainly be an extreme example, right, yes.
But it is affects sure. many people.
It does indeed, sure. It flows into the Illinois, and that goes by the homes of thousands, tens of thousands, right?
What are some of the ethical issues about rivers in terms of the law?
If you just think about the functions that rivers perform, the things that they do, the way we use them, I think that would provide a point of beginning for an answer. Obviously, if you're polluting somebody else's drinking water, that's a problem. If there are people downstream who are used to getting their food from the river, from fish, their economic livelihood, and that's been undercut, that's a problem.
Or recreation.
Recreation, sure. Aesthetics.
Swimming,
aesthetics. I mean, we don't even need to get to the sort of ecological issues to stumble upon a number of issues. I mean, Illinois, as I think many people in the state realize, at one time had a very flourishing mussel industry along the Illinois River, the Mississippi River. I mean, the turn of the last century, that around 1900, there was a huge booming mussel industry, and I suppose you know why that is. Maybe not all listeners do. The freshwater mussels were made into buttons. Before the era of plastics, they would be stamped out. Oh, no, Illinois was widely known around the world. It was the button capital of the world.
I had no idea.
Because of the very productive freshwater mussel industry.
Huh.
Now, much of that faded away with the coming of plastics, but well before the plastics came in, the mussel industry was very badly affected by by the alteration of the waterways, the pollution. A lot of it was the silt. A lot of the mussel species can just get smothered with silt because, of course, once they're in place, they don't move.
Mm-hmm.
So if the water coming to them is polluted, or if the silt comes and just covers them up, there's nothing they can do about it, really. So,
and what about the barge traffic and the dredging that it takes to keep
those? Oh, yes. A lot of that's right. That's been part of it.
A lot of it's the stream
bank. Well, it's certainly in the big, right. Mm-hmm. The stream bank erosion from the kind of drainage, the flooding. Some of it is polluted. Of course, the mussel species are variously sensitive. But actually, there is no category of life in this state that is more imperiled than mussels. We have lost a lot of species. Most of the rest of them are threatened or endangered. If you wanted to sort of look for those types of life that are most imperiled in our state, the place to start would be mussels.
Now, in what sense, Where does private property come into this whole issue? I mean, who owns the rivers and the streams and the drainage ditches?
This is a wonderful question you've asked, and it's one of many that makes me think that this is just a wonderfully fascinating subject. And I've been in this for years, and I think you could study the subject and think about it for many lifetimes. Illinois has a lot of interesting rules on the subject. We are one of the many states that actually says to landowners who own land along rivers that your landed property rights extend to the middle of the river.
Like also to the middle of the roads, yeah. Some cases.
In many cases, right, mm-hmm. Yeah. That depends on whether when roads were laid out, the municipalities bought just an easement or whether they bought a fee interest. But in the case of the rivers, yes, if your property extends to the edge of the river, you are deemed to own to the middle. And, of course, if you own both sides of the river, then you have – and this is true even of large navigable rivers. It's true of the Illinois. It's true of the Mississippi.
Really?
If you own land on the Mississippi River, your land goes out to the middle. Now, obviously, that's subject to a lot of public rights to make use of the river, so that your rights are very limited. But every once in a while, an issue comes up where your ownership of the land is important. Actually, in one area that's always been important is mussels, because the mussels that are on the ground are yours.
Under the water.
Under the water, because they attach to the ground, the soil, they are considered part of yours. But there was a fascinating case some years ago involving a bridge on the Mississippi that was being repaired, and there was a barge company that came in to work on the river, and they were sinking their supports into the ground there, and the landowner shows up and says, hey, you're trespassing. He wins. I mean, that's true.
And if people upstream do things that keep the mussels
– you've put your finger on a very good question. Because very often people upstream want to do things on their land that harm landowners downstream. In fact, the vast majority – you were asking earlier about land use regulation. The main reason why government gets involved in land use regulation is because it necessarily has to set a rule to resolve disputes among competing landowners. It's not private property versus something else. It's one landowner's private property versus another landowner's private property. And the government has to sort of decide who's going to get to go it. Is it the upstream landowner who wants to drain? Is it the downstream landowner who says, hey, you're flooding, you're destroying my stream banks, you're ruining my fisheries or something? So there's private property on both sides, and you can't resolve a dispute by that simply by saying, I'm going to be in favor of property rights.
We have a caller waiting to join the conversation. Let me encourage others. 1-800-222-9455 is our toll-free number. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with Professor Freifogel. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was interested in a comment that Professor Freifogel made earlier regarding the fact, or at least his sense, that if anything, there has been too much drainage going on in Champaign County. My question is, how do a group of farmers or landowners get their hands around a consensus about what's sufficient for drainage purposes and what's not?
How do they figure that out?
There is no magic rule here to be followed. There is no calculator that you can put in numbers into an equation and something pops out. It really is a judgment call. Keeping in mind that there really is no pro-private property answer to this. I mean, if what one landowner does is necessarily going to affect other landowners, and you've got to sort of decide what you think it means to be a responsible landowner in Champaign County. I think that necessarily there has to be some accommodation. There has to be some compromises among landowners. I mean, nobody is going to be able to get what he wants. I happen to think it's useful in cases like this, really, first of all, to make sure that you've got the facts right in terms of how much drainage really is needed and what the cost is of not draining. Because I think it's very easy for people to exaggerate that. Let's translate it into dollars and cents. If one landowner says, oh, gee, my farm fields aren't draining very well, Well, that's a concern. But let's go out and say, all right, how many acres are you talking about? What is the effect on crop yield? You know, let's come up with sort of a dollar value of this. You know, if the answer is, oh, gee, it's 2 or 3 acres and it means I can't get my, you know, fields planted until a few weeks late. I mean, I don't mean to be completely unsympathetic, but you know, if you've got a handful of landowners like that and the question is, are we going to spend $700,000 of taxpayer money to deal with this? We might sort of say, you know, maybe we shouldn't. But it's I could talk about the issue a long time because really to think about it thoroughly, we need to look at the ecological health of our rivers. We need to think about the benefit that they provide to the community at large. But ultimately, of course, it's a judgment call. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can bring in your engineers, you can bring in your scientific experts, but frankly, engineers are there to do what you tell them to, and scientists are there merely to help you learn about how nature functions. In the end, though, these are judgment calls on public policy, and although it's good for them to be informed judgment calls, ultimately we have to decide what kind of community we want, what we're going to value. I mean, in extreme cases, if we really are overburdening some individual landowner, we might say, all right, we're going to ask you to cut back. We know it's going to hurt you greatly. Maybe we're going to compensate you a little bit for this. But the truth is that you know, landowners in lots and lots of ways, particularly in the city, goodness, I mean, have to, you know, face restraints on what they can do. I mean, people in the city know this all the time. Their lands are subject to severe restrictions on what they can do. I mean, if I own a house, I can't, you know, say I'm going to tear it down and put in a McDonald's. I mean, forget it. Maybe I would make a lot of money if I did that. Mm-hmm. But this idea that you can use your land in whatever way makes the most money is not a principle of our property law. I wish I had a clear answer to you, but ultimately it's going to be a judgment call.
Would you like to follow up, caller?
Well, I guess I understand that there are, what, almost 100 drainage districts in this county, and they are governed by a board of 3 individuals, and is it... the responsibility of just those 3 to basically make the decisions that you were alluding to, both immediate and maybe long term, or are they there because they have contact with other landowners in the immediate area and this conversation about what's in the best interest or what's best for the common good is going on a regular basis?
You know, you have asked, I think, a wonderful question. And if I might, I actually want to broaden the question a little bit. I think that one of the reasons why land use regulation often gets a bad name or land use decisions by government often gets a bad name is precisely because the people who are making the decisions are given a very narrow charter. They're told to go out and do one thing, think about the one thing, and then they make land use decisions which accomplish that one thing but have a lot of ripple effects that ought to be considered but aren't. In this case, it's a drainage district, but I could give you lots of other examples. I mean, if you set up a separate district and their sole obligation is to do historic preservation and that's all they think about, or they're there to protect a coastal zone or something, it's these single function governmental units that are given a small charter, one thing to do, but inevitably when they do that one thing, they are doing a lot of other things at the same time. They are making decisions that have widespread implications, and they're not adequately thinking about the larger context. I actually have grave troubles with districts like this of any sort unless somebody at a higher level makes essentially the big policy decision. Somebody at a higher level says, we are the ones who can look at the large landscape. We can consider the needs of the whole county, all of the people, the recreation, the ecological health of the river. We are the ones in a position to balance drainage against other things. We have done that. Here are the conclusions we come to. And it's your more narrow job than to carry this out. If you, though, set up people to run drainage districts and all they think about is drainage, all they want to do is drain, well, inevitably, that's what they're going to do. They're going to drain. And I don't mean to be blaming them. I mean, the problem is systemic. If it was historic preservation, if it was the coastal zone, I mean, Frankly, I think our country is plagued with specialty groups. I will say I have thought about this. I've written a lot about it in my book. I think that private property is a flexible institution and it needs to be reformed in lots of ways. But I think that it is our efforts to do so are diminished by the number of government units that are out there making decisions about private property, decisions that actually affect private property as an institution without thinking about the larger context. You can't make effective drainage decisions or historic preservation decisions or protecting wildlife habitat decisions without thinking about the big picture. And somebody's got to do it.
Thank you for your insight.
Thank you, caller. Let me play devil's advocate one more time. What about the people who may not be in a governmental unit but might be single focused on, say, preserving the environment?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Or who has the broader picture there? Because people do have to make a living. People may choose to live in ways that may not be approved by all. Mm-hmm. How do you balance those kind of interests?
Let me get back to my book.
Okay.
The Land We Share. I mean, the title is...
Sharing is important.
And by share, I mean we live on the land together, and inevitably what one person does affects other people. That would be point one. The second thing, my book is about private property. Now, we tend to think about private property in individualistic terms, that if I own something, it's my personal sphere of activity, and that private property perhaps exists as an extension of individual liberty, that we're a land of liberty. When we let people own land, that extends their liberty. And there is certainly some truth to that. But if we would back up even further, though, and realize that private property is inherently a social institution. If you run out and grab land and claim to own it, that's not the origin of property. Property arises when other people stop and say, you know what, we are going to recognize your ownership mm-hmm. and honor it and protect it. Mm-hmm. That when you're the owner of land, you really don't want the government to leave you alone. What you want is the government to stand behind you. Mm-hmm. You want the police there. You want the courts there. You want the laws there. So what you really want to do is call upon state power to protect your sphere of influence against other people who might want to come on. That if you own a huge tract of land, I mean, let me use a good example. Northern Scotland today, a huge issue. Huge landowners, many of them absentee, they never show up on their land. Mm-hmm. You've got thousands of people who would love to come hiking on those lands, but there's big no trespassing signs. Now, are we really expanding liberty if we say the landowner can keep all these people off?
Mm.
Well, we are expanding the owner's liberty, but what about the liberty of these thousands of people who want to come on?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, private property really is an institution that works only by limiting the liberty of the non-owners. So when you say, this is my land, stay off, you're obviously using government power to limit the liberty of other people. So all of that's just by way of saying that necessarily these issues are interrelated. The more that we recognize the rights of an owner, the more we are necessarily curtailing the liberties and the rights of other people. So we are all in this together. I mean, I guess that's the bottom line. We are all in this together. Necessarily, that means to me that private property has to be justified in terms of its contribution to the common good, hence mm-hmm. my subtitle, Private mm-hmm. Property and the Common Good. I think that's got to be the main justification for private rights. We should only be recognizing private property rights in nature to the extent that we collectively benefit by doing so. Now, we, of course, can benefit when we recognize strong private rights. I mean, there's things that are good things when we let people, you know, plow and plant their fields and they get the crops in the fall, but that we all benefit from this economic productivity. So, I mean, that my argument isn't one that undercuts individual mm-hmm. rights, but it always says, ultimately, we have to keep going back to the fundamental justification. Private property is a good thing for us when and because it promotes the common good. And we've got to be able to justify things in that way, whether it's your right to have a factory that smokes, whether it's your right to drain your land in a way that harms the river, to cut down the trees, to alter the wildlife habitat, to build houses. Mm-hmm. If you're a suburbanite, to put chemicals on your lawn that run away. All of these are exercises of rights. And what I would say is it's entirely appropriate always for us to stop and say, is it good for the community, for us collectively, to let you do these things? If the answer is no, I think your property right becomes problematic. You know what? Or another way to express this very simply, when you ask about property rights, when a landowner says, I think I should have the right to do X, the question ought to be, what's in it for the non-owners? In what way are other people going to be benefited by this?
In a way, when a governmental unit allows someone to buy purchase a property, mm-hmm. and the governmental unit says, "All right, you can farm it, or you can build a house on it, or you can build an apartment house or a mall or whatever," that they decide, the decision you're suggesting is it's because, in the long run, for most people, in the long haul, for a while. It seemed to be for the common good.
I think so, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It needs to be
But you really
way.
Have to trust people, don't you? Because even, you know, like when I was given permission to buy these 2 acres of farmland to put a house on, the county in that case said, all right, it's appropriate, it's legal, we'll let you do it. Here are certain restrictions. But they trusted me with those 2 acres. Now, it happens, one of the first things I did was plant over 100 trees on it. I think that's for the common good, not only for it'll keep the wind from – it's a nice windbreak for where our house is, but it's also a place for birds. It's also sure. helps the oxygen. We decided to put in some natural prairie. Okay, that's aesthetic. It's something we'll enjoy looking at and seeing wildlife in. But on the other hand, after I bought it, mm-hmm. all I had to do to meet the requirements was put up a house. Mm-hmm. I could just let that topsoil run down the road, or I could put, as you say, all kinds of poisons on it. And unless somebody sued me, mm-hmm. It could be going into the rivers. So it takes a lot of trust in people, doesn't it?
Sure it does. Well, I mean, and if people live up to the trust, if most people do, if there's no problems, then, there's no particular reason to impose restrictions. I mean, like most people, I think we should not have restrictions unless there's a particular reason for them. But certainly the more congested people are, the more the close they are in proximity, the more intensively they alter the land, the greater the ecological ripple effects, inevitably we're going to see more land use controls.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly see it in more crowded places around the world. The property rights, lots of countries have private property rights, but in many cases what landowners can do independently is a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in our country, it's, I wish we had time to talk about this. In our country, we've got a long history of land use controls.
Mm-hmm.
In colonial America had a very rich history of land use controls. I mean, I will mention only one because it's so related to your point, is that in colonial Philadelphia, there was a law that required landowners to plant trees along public sidewalks to provide shade.
A wonderful example, but we are going to have to stop there. We have run out of time. Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Professor Eric Freifogel, who's the author of the recent book published just last summer, The Land We Share, Private Property, and the Common Good. Next week on Keeping the Faith, February 15, we'll be talking with two people who are involved in the Whirlwind Project in Champaign-Urbana, Mujahid Al-Fayyad, who is the imam at the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, and Allison Entrekin, who is the chairperson of the Whirlwind Project. Coming up the following week, Professor Bill Kegel from Millikan University will be talking about Revelation. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
You watch two trench-coated boys walk into their high school and shoot everyone in sight. Then a demon drags them off to be tortured in hell. No, it's not the latest video game. It's Hell House, a Halloween haunted house put on by a church in Texas. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll look at today's Christianity, making Jesus cool. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont; Thrifty Nickel, Champaign; and GCOM Incorporated in Savoy. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries after midnight. The low in the lower 20s with south winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries. The high in the mid-30s with southwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with the low in the lower 20s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour.
You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.